Welcome back to another episode of the Meat Mafia podcast. If this is your first time joining us, we have one goal and one goal only, and that is that you, yes, you, listen to this podcast and get at least one valuable piece of information that inspires you to go radically change your health today. If this is your second, third, fourth, or 100th time listening to the Meat Mafia podcast, we are so grateful to have you, and we are so thankful for your continued support. Before we get going, if you would not mind going and following us on all of our platforms, YouTube, Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, and of course, Twitter, we would greatly appreciate it. This just allows us to expand our reach, and your reviews, comments, and feedback give us more and more things to think about and improve the show with. Lastly, this is a user-supported podcast and newsletter, and we would not be able to do what we love doing without your generous support and the support from our sponsors. We take great pride in the relationships that we've built with our sponsors and truly believe that they are the best resources out there for better health. Your support and their support, and you supporting them, means the world to us. If you are enjoying the podcast and getting value out of it, please check us out on the Fountain app below, where you can support us by streaming us sats or sending us support via our Fountain Bitcoin wallet. Without further ado, here is a word from our sponsors. This episode of the podcast is brought to you by The Carnivore Bar. The Carnivore Bar is a veteran-owned, animal-based company focused on bringing you the highest quality pemmican product on the market. Pemmican is an ancient tradition practiced by American indigenous cultures, and it's focused on simple ingredients, beef, tallow, and salt. It's built for grab-and-go snacking, and it's a great sort of travel, hiking, or school lunch snack. And it's really built for those long-lasting days where you can just run on basically no fuel other than just simple fats. It's rich in saturated fats and provides everything you need to sustain long-lasting energy throughout the busy day. In my opinion, this is a product that is an absolute must, so go check it out in the link below. Also, check out our podcast with the founder, Philip Meese. He does an incredible job breaking down the mission and the passion behind the company. And I think if you're interested in animal-based nutrition, Philip will inspire you with his product. This episode of the podcast is also brought to you by Holy Cow Beef. Holy Cow Beef is regeneratively raised, grass-fed, grass-finished beef raised right here in Lubbock, Texas. Regeneratively raised, grass-fed, grass-finished beef is the gold standard of beef, and Ann and Weldon Warren have made it their lives' mission to provide incredibly high-quality beef to their local community and beyond. They have been raising their animals this way for decades. In fact, they were some of the most influential voices for getting grass-fed and grass-finished beef in Whole Foods back when Whole Foods was a startup grocery store. They were influential in setting the AGA standards, which is the American Grass-Fed Association, so you know they are doing things the right way, and on top of all of that, their beef tastes like butter. Grass-fed, grass-finished beef provides a superior omega-3 to omega-6 ratio than your typical beef, or in other words, it causes less inflammation in your body. So you are promoting a high protein, high fat diet with this amazingly high quality beef, and saturated fats are playing their critical role in benefiting your body through supporting hormonal functions and cellular functions. And if you're looking for the highest quality beef, look no further than Holy Cow Beef. Leave your butcher box, that Australian and New Zealand raised meat, in the cart and order from your friends Ann and Weldon Warren over at Holy Cow Beef. I almost forgot the most important part there. Ann and Weldon Warren also accept Bitcoin as payment. So go check them out at their website in the link below, and you can pay in Bitcoin or in cash if you're looking to save your Bitcoin. I don't know about you all, but I am all about rewriting the incentives when it comes to healthcare, and CrowdHealth is doing just that. CrowdHealth is essentially crowdfunding for healthcare with a small HSA component mixed in. Paying through the nose for health insurance you may never use, only to be turned away when you actually need it, is incredibly frustrating. Also, the exorbitant costs of health insurance has so many baked-in premiums that when you compare settling your doctor's bills by paying in cash versus using insurance, the cost is astronomical. So crowdfunding allows you to settle your medical bills in cash and then get the funding you need from your group through CrowdHealth. This is a great alternative to health insurance for people who are low-risk, healthy people who just want peace of mind knowing that if anything actually did happen, they do have a pool of funds to pull from to cover their medical costs. The best part? My group is saving a portion of the monthly opt-in in Bitcoin, and the rest is in cash. So those savings are going towards actually preserving long-term value for my group through a vehicle like Bitcoin. We are really excited about this concept, and since the business model is predicated on an incentive-based healthcare, it is a great, great concept. For people with low risk, minimal healthcare costs, it is a no-brainer. Go check them out in the link below and use our promo code MAFIA for a discount on your first 6 months with CrowdHealth. Rolling start.
Awesome.
Well, Joe, dude, excited to have you on the podcast.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me, guys.
We were saying how we had got connected was in April at the What Good Shall I Do, the Regenerative Ag Conference. And, you know, the serendipity of these in-person events, you just meet and shake hands with people and you never know the relationships that are going to come from it. So we were just sitting at that bar seat and I think we were like the first three people that were there because we got there early. And we just started kind of shooting the shit. And we were just so impressed by you and the farm that you had built out. And I just assumed that you were older because you don't meet a lot of younger first gen farmers that are doing what you're doing. And I think, are you 28 or 27?
You know what's funny? The other day I was filling something out and I was like, how old am I? Yeah. I couldn't remember if I was 26 or 27. I'm 27.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. So we were so impressed. We're like, here's a young guy who's doing all these amazing things. And it's cool to connect with other younger people in the space. So I think as a starting point, man, I think just learning a little bit more about your story and how you got into farming. And also, we haven't done a lot of focus on chicken. We talk a lot about beef, but I think this is going to be a great episode for our guests.
Yeah. Yeah. So my story is a little bit different than most. So I kind of fell into it out of boredom, to be honest. So I was not good at sports. And I was looking for something as a kid, I mean, looking for something to do, right? And I was mowing lawns and stuff like that, but I wanted kind of a hobby to begin with. And my cousin showed rabbits in 4-H. And she was like, why don't you come to a 4-H meeting and just see if you like it? So I went and didn't think too much of it. It was okay. And then a few weeks later, maybe a month later, my dad and I went into Tractor Supply. I don't know if you guys have those down here or not, but they were having their chick days. And long story short, we ended up with three baby chickens, raised them in a fish tank in our house. Didn't know any, I mean, I'm first generation, don't know anything about farming. Raised those up and then just started selling the eggs to my aunts and, you know, friends of the family. And it kind of grew into an obsession of like an entrepreneurial spirit of like, I can produce something and offer people a product that they want to spend money on. That's kind of how it started. And then it just grew. We lived in the suburbs of Kalamazoo, which is not a huge town, but the city council started talking like, are chickens legal here? Are they a pet? Are they a farm animal? Like, what are they? Well, they decided that six chickens was going to be the limit in the city. And we had 50 or 80 of them in our garage and everywhere on the on the house. And so my dad was like, okay, we gotta do something else because we can't have these here. So he found a 2.5 acre lot outside of town. And that's where I started the farm with like 150 chickens or so.
So how do you decide between choosing like just going the egg route versus the meat route? Because I know there's both and they're so different.
Yeah. So the eggs, I think I kind of just fell into the eggs at first. And that's kind of was just what I started doing because that's what I bought. If I had bought like a meat chicken, then I probably would have done that more. But the eggs was, they were good because it was just a weekly, you know, a return customer that came back every single week.
Right.
So that was enjoyable. We scaled in 2020, we had 6,000 egg laying chickens. Wow. Today we've got 25. So we're pretty much just now. So we've completely transitioned to all meat. And we're doing beef, chicken and turkey.
How old were you when you got that 2.5 acre plot of land?
I think I was 14 or 15.
Wow. So you were really young.
Yeah. So most moms are driving their kids around to like baseball practice or soccer You know, my mom was bringing me to farmers markets and people meeting people in Walmart parking lots to sell them eggs. So it was pretty funny.
That's hilarious. People were
like, they would message me on Facebook or something and they wouldn't expect it to be like a 15-year-old kid.
When was it clear to you that you were like just on this path, like this was going to be your thing that you wanted to lean into for the rest of your life?
So it's funny. We were at a farmer's market inside a hospital and a guy named Grant Fletcher came up to me and was like, hey, we want to start buying pasture-raised eggs for the hospital. I was like, oh, that's awesome. Like, I doubt I'm anywhere near the amount you guys need. He was like, yeah, you're not. And you need to have a licensed washing facility. So I was like, okay, well, I was probably 15 or 16 at that time. And by the time I was 18, I finally got the washing facility. So I was legal and everything. And then I scaled up to, I think they were buying maybe 300 dozen a week. And then I was like, man, I'm bringing in $600, whatever it was, mm-hmm. $900 a week. And I was thinking, this is crazy. Like, I could make a business out of this. Yeah. Like, this is more than just like a side thing now. And then from there, it just kind of snowballed, like talking. Well, with them, we grew more with them, started raising them chicken and stuff. And then just started going into like restaurants and grocery stores and farm store. I mean, just, I was just looking for every avenue I could to sell eggs.
You're probably the richest man alive amongst all your friends in high school too.
I thought so at least.
But in all seriousness, it's probably interesting just having all that responsibility at such a young age and having an actual business, right? It's like you're 16 years old,
right,
and you're servicing hospitals and all these different businesses. It's incredible how young you were to actually build that out.
Yeah, it was pretty cool because, you know, as a young kid, you're like, everyone kind of thinks you're up to no good. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of cool to be like, oh, I'm actually doing something like, you know, legitimate.
Equip's Unflavored Prime has one single ingredient derived directly from grass-fed beef protein. For purists like ourselves who try to only consume balanced, real sources of nutrition, this protein powder checks all the boxes. Go check them out in the link below and use our promo code in the description to get a discount.
Well, it's funny too because, in the United States, there's not a whole lot that's produced here anymore. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like we've kind of outsourced a lot of different manufacturing roles overseas and, you know, we're growing up during the age of the internet where most right. people are thinking about like a tech job. So for you to fall into this passion of yours where it's about raising food, average age of a farmer now is over 60. And now here you are at 15 doing your thing. It's really cool to see.
Yeah. Yeah. That is really unfortunate that the average age is like, I think it's 68 or mm-hmm. something like
That's
that.
That's crazy.
It's really not good. I mean, we're going to have a big problem in a few years if we don't get more either young people into farming or allow the young people that are farming to have a lot less red tape because it's pretty constricting sometimes for government regulation stuff.
Are you seeing more interest from people like our age or even a little bit older, just like showing up and trying to learn a little bit more about what you're doing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the regenerative movement is going to help with that age gap a lot because a lot of people, so like even in 4-H, a lot of people were coming from farming backgrounds, but they see their dad hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt to buy a huge combine, mm-hmm. barely making enough to make the payments. Mom has to work another job. Dad's got to work another job off farm. It's like they don't want anything to do with that.
Yeah.
So they're getting out of that kind of farming, but the regenerative is like, oh, this is something I've got a passion for. I can make money. I'm producing something to be proud of. So it's allowing people to get in and you can get in pretty, I mean, you don't have to have any huge equipment or anything. I mean, you don't even have to have land. You can mm-hmm. rent land. So,
yeah. How often do you come across other young first-gen regenerative farmers similar to yourself?
If it's at like a conference, then I meet them mm-hmm. Day to day, hardly ever. Mm.
So you mentioned regenerative. What is, I feel like this is kind of a hot topic mm-hmm. and regenerative specific to poultry is, I think, somewhat unique. Like there's all these different people have an opinion on whether even poultry can be regenerative. Yep. So I'm wondering if you have a position on that and just how you articulate that to people who maybe ask that question.
Yeah, that's a great question. And to be completely honest, if the entire chain can be regenerative at the moment, I'm not entirely sure because they are monogastric. So they're eating a lot of times corn, soy, or even if they're not eating corn and soy, they're still eating some kind of crop that's grown. You know, unlike a cow that can just eat the pasture that's right mm-hmm. there. and turn it into protein. Right. Chickens have to have that input of feed. They can't just live off of grass.
Mm-hmm.
So to that degree, I'm not entirely sure. I think there's going to be a lot of movement in that area of trying to raise those things, or food alternatives like larva, like some kind of bug,
right,
to help in their diet. But if we can at least raise the animal in a way on the farm that is leaving the soil healthier than it was before, then that's at least a good stepping stone.
Yeah. We were talking before we hit record about low PUFA chicken.
Yep.
And I'm just curious, like what would you consider to be a species appropriate diet? Cause there's a lot of talk about, you know, corn and soy free chicken.
Yeah.
I'm just curious your perspective on that. Cause it's such a contentious topic. Yeah. Now.
So we raise both. We raise, okay, non-GMO corn and soy, raised chickens. And then we also raise corn and soy free chickens. And then the corn and soy free, the feed is technically certified organic. We're not certified organic, but, corn and soy, if there was soy, maybe. But I've never seen a chicken fly up onto a corn stalk and try to eat corn, you know, naturally in the wild. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't even say that's a natural diet, because the chances of them getting it until it's laid down on the ground, and corn's relatively new. I mean, it came from maize not that long ago.
Right.
So it's not like chickens were developed over time eating a bunch of corn. I would say a natural diet would be natural seeds, nuts, but mostly bugs and worms.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yes, our chickens eat a lot of grass, but there's a certain time of year where we get a bunch of grasshoppers on our farm. And when we move their shelter every day to fresh pasture, they aren't going after the grass at first. They're going after those bugs first and foremost.
Right.
So I would, like, wild turkeys, a huge portion of their diet is bugs.
Mm. One of the things that we've been hearing more and more is, like, you are what your food eats.
Yep.
And I think, like, this, what you're talking about speaks exactly to that. But how do you make sure that, you know, your animals are not only, like, getting the right foods that they need and being healthy? Like, is there's the diet component. It's almost like people, right? There's the diet component. There's the lifestyle component. It's like, what are you doing on the farm to, like, make sure those chickens are as healthy as they can be?
Yeah. So the nutrition side, we really trust, and you have to trust your feed supplier, because we're not raising our own feed and grinding and everything. So having a good relationship with the food supplier, and then having, you know, knowing what's in it, you know, and having the transparency of, okay, maybe it's not as perfect as it can be in the future, but let's get it as good as we can get, tell everyone what it is so they know. So that's kind of the nutrition side, aside from what they're getting naturally from the pasture. What we have the most control over is what we do day to day, which is move them to fresh pasture, getting them off their own manure every day, and then allowing them to have no ammonia. It's fresh air, no ammonia. They have got sunlight. I mean, we all know the benefits of sunlight for ourselves and animals. It's just the same.
Yeah.
Yeah. When we're buying eggs and broilers, either at the grocery store or the farm, what do you think are just good questions to be maybe asking the farmer, or just things to be looking for? Like, is it even possible to get good eggs and broilers from the grocery store?
Depends on the grocery store.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a lot of greenwashing, especially in poultry. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous.
I've been seeing it a lot more in Whole Foods. Like, this seems like it's just total greenwashing.
Whole Foods it's like the Walmart for quote unquote healthy food, in my opinion. I mean, yes, Vital Farms is better than like a chicken raised in a cage, but their model is a long barn with a hole cut in the side, and maybe the chickens go out. They're not regenerating anything, and they're not we have to force our chickens to go. Well, we don't have to, but we do force our chickens to move to fresh pasture every day. If we just kept, it'd be like keeping them in one spot. They're not going to go that far. They're going to go, depends on the chicken. A laying hen would go maybe 100 yards from their coop, and that's about it. So they're just, all their manure is going to be concentrated in one spot. And then they're going to eat up all the bugs and all the grass real quick. It's not, if you're not moving them, because that's actually how we started. So I didn't start with pastured poultry. I started with like a free range model, just like that, with chicken coops, and then just let them outside, which can work to a certain degree as maybe like a couple hundred chickens. Mm-hmm. Then we found after like 200 or 300 chickens in a coop, they just stay inside, and you really need them outside and forcing them to move onto fresh pasture every day.
So that would be a question to ask.
Are they being moved? And how frequently?
Yeah. So can free range, can that term be greenwashed as well?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the standard, I don't even know if there is a legal standard. There is for organic, I believe. But I think it's just access to pasture, which could be a 1,200 foot long barn with a 1x1 door at one end. Maybe 1% of them go outside. Mm-hmm. Maybe they don't even do that.
Interesting. So there's cage-free, pasture-raised. Mm-hmm. What else is there?
What do they love to say? Vegetarian fed or something? Greenwashing. Yeah.
If you're vegetarian fed, then you know they're not outside at all. Because chickens will eat mice. They'll eat snakes. They'll eat grasshoppers. They'll eat any bug they can get. But they'll eat small rodents and reptiles too. Mm-hmm. I mean, they'll eat carcasses. I mean, they're definitely not a vegetarian to any degree. They'll eat carcasses of deer, of anything.
When you were first starting, were you using like food waste to feed them at all? Because I know Joel Salatin talks about that all the time. Like if everyone had like a chicken in their house, we could eliminate food waste.
Yeah, it's awesome that they can literally turn, kind of like a pig, they can turn just scraps into either meat or a delicious egg. We did a lot with, there was a bakery in town, kind of a commercial bakery though, and they had a lot of like old breads and stuff like that. So we started doing that. But then as we started thinking about it more, we were like, well, do we really want to, because it's just like white, you know, bleached flour bread. We're like, do we want to be feeding that to our chickens if we don't even want to necessarily eat a bunch of that ourselves? Mm-hmm. So then we got away from that. But that, I mean, it still is a good way to use that up if you don't have that mentality of like, I need to have an egg that has never been fed white bread. But
yeah. Is it true that the orange yolk doesn't actually mean that it's like more nutrient dense? You can kind of specifically feed them carotenoids or something like that?
Yeah,
or?
So there's certain flowers off the top of my head. I'm trying to think what they are, but marigold is one of them.
Yeah.
And it just turns the, like, you'll see. I really try not to, I'm not trying to bash Vital Farm. They are better than most, but they do a lot of greenwashing and their yolks are like super dark orange. Mm-hmm. And ours, even being moved to pasture every day, aren't necessarily that dark.
Yeah. So would a healthy egg yolk be more orange naturally? Or like, are they doing that just to make it, I mean, they're obviously doing that for a reason.
Yeah, they're doing it for marketing purposes. But in theory, yes, if you just took like a caged egg, didn't do anything to the feed special, and then took like a, and it depends on the time of year too for the pasture. I mean, there's certain times where it's blooming with all sorts of flowers and whatever, bunch of bugs, it can change over time, especially up by us, because in the winter our customers actually kind of enjoyed the fact that the yolks would get a little paler in the winter because they knew it was legitimate.
Yeah,
like if they stayed consistent and looked the same all the time all year long, it's just not true. It's just they're getting something that's not right.
Yeah. And I know you're not trying to bash on Vital Farms either, and you said they do things better than most, but I think it is important for people to understand the greenwashing and the marketing and things that are going on with their product. Because even with us, I feel like I could know more about eggs and chicken because we focus so much on beef.
Yep.
We've just never really dove into some of these topics before.
Yeah. And you can, I mean, the thing is they don't really try to hide it either. So if there's no real definition of pasture raised. In my opinion, it means movement. Mm-hmm. But then again, up by us, if you have egg laying chickens in the winter, they're not being moved.
Yeah.
So is it really pasture raised all winter long? That's why I really push people to know the farm you're buying stuff from. Mm-hmm. That's super important, especially if you can get there and see what's going on just once. Like, you don't have to be there every week to pick something up, but just if there's a farm you trust, like, make a trip there, see it, either agree with it or disagree with it, and then move on accordingly. But yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say that's pasture raised. And greenwashing, if the regenerative movement comes to a screeching halt, it's going to be because of greenwashing.
Yeah. This is purely anecdotal, but one thing I have noticed is that there's almost like a difference in the density of the shell depending on what farm I buy from.
Yep.
Like, is more density a good sign? Does it matter?
That would be age of chicken, actually.
Age of chicken.
Yeah, okay. So the older they get, the softer their shells get.
Okay.
So the common chicken nowadays would be like some type of Isa Brown, which is what lays like a production red is what they're also called, or Highlines. There's all sorts of different types of these chickens, but they've been bred to lay so many eggs that the chicken can't actually consume enough calcium to lay that many eggs. So as they get older, they actually start grafting it from their legs and from their wings and their bones to make those shells. So over time, like, they won't be able to sustain that amount of egg laying for very long. But so as they get older and they start to lose that calcium, their shells get a lot weaker.
One of the things that has really surprised me as I've learned more about the food system is how quickly some of these animals are raised and processed. Mm-hmm. Is that something you think about when you're raising chickens? Like, do you want more mature chickens when it comes to meat versus eggs? Or, you know, like, I know, like, most of them are, like, pretty juvenile when they get mm-hmm. slaughtered at a lot of these big processing facilities.
Yeah.
Which to me, it's like, okay, is that a healthy bird if it's a young bird?
Right. So for chicken, it's kind of difficult. There are breeds out there that might be processed at like 10 to 12 weeks. Commercially, birds are generally killed at about 6 weeks, but we're not much longer. We're like seven mm-hmm. to 8 weeks.
Wow.
We use like a Cornish cross, which is just a generic commercial breed of chicken. Obviously, the way we raise them and time of year has a lot to do with it because ours are outside. So like our batches that are finishing in like June and July, when the sun is a lot out a lot longer, those birds grow a lot bigger and faster than, let's say, a batch ending in May or in October, because there's just not as much daylight, not as much time for them to eat, feed, mm-hmm. not, you know, all sorts of things. So when you're in a barn, I mean, you can have consistent same daylight. Well, it's not daylight, but
yeah.
same light all day long. They can get them pretty big, pretty fast.
Mm.
As far as like the nutrition of the meat, there could be an argument that an older chicken has had more time to consume more if it's quality forage, that maybe there is more nutrition in the meat, but it's going to be a lot tougher, which has been a big drawback for a lot of people. Mm. There's a breed called Freedom Ranger. And they take about 12 to 14 weeks. And there was a big movement about 4 years ago, and a lot of farms started doing those. And people just, it was too tough. People are so used to a big, like, breast on a chicken
mm-hmm.
that these had skinny breasts. They just weren't used to it. And it was just too much of a change that a lot of people went back to the chicken that everyone knows, but raising it in a way better way.
Interesting. Yeah, it's funny how Americans were obsessed with the breast of the chicken. And I'm like, give me the thighs, oh my the gosh, legs, the drumsticks. Like, that's where all the juicy stuff is. Right?
I know. I don't understand the obsession with chicken breasts.
Dry chicken breasts. It's insane. Do you notice a difference in the taste between your corn and soy fed chickens and the non-corn and soy fed chickens?
I do, actually. It's not ginormous, but there is, it seems like, it's funny that you just said dry chicken breast, because it does seem like there's actually more moisture in the corn and soy free chickens than there
is.
And they do grow a little bit slower. So that might have something to do with it also. And they might be a little bit more active to some degree, which would help with the juiciness too, because a used muscle, that's what causes it to bring in flavor and moisture,
mm-hmm.
Which the chest doesn't get used very much on a chicken. So if they are using it a little bit more, it can make a big difference.
Mm. There was this report that was, I think like a few months ago, it was released. It's called the Food Barons report. And it talked about concentration in the food system.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that stood out to me was like the genetics in chicken and poultry mm-hmm. is controlled by so few people so few companies. And I'm wondering, like, what do you as a, you know, farmer who's focused specifically on poultry
mm-hmm.
do or think about when it comes to genetics? Because I just have no idea what that even looks like when you're looking to get you know, your next batch of chickens.
Yeah, there's not a ton of variety out there. There was a good, it was White Oaks was using that, White Oaks Pastures was using a chicken from a hatchery, and then that hatchery got bought, and then the new company just stopped this breed. I can't remember what it was, like Robust White or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they took like a week or two longer, but Will said that they grew out great. They tasted good. But really, there's a lot to be done in the genetics of chicken.
Mm-hmm.
A, to get it out of the hands of the big guys so that they don't have full control. But also, these chickens were bred to be put in a barn day one and to be taken out of a barn 42 days later and to never see anything over 75 degrees and nothing under 60 degrees. So there's just resilience could be bred into the breed of chicken for sure.
Is it true that some of these industrial birds are so fat that they're literally like falling over when they're trying to walk? Is that
some of that's a little overdone. when they get really big, they will start to like waddle mm-hmm. a little bit. It's probably not as extreme as you see some of the videos, just because when you think about it, I mean, that doesn't help that farmer either.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, they don't want their chickens die. They don't get paid if that chicken dies before it goes to the processor. But they can, I mean, to be completely honest, we've had some. So when we first started, so when we go to the processor, we load our chickens into these crates that we then put on a truck and bring to the processor. And when we first started, we didn't know anything about meat chickens. And we were loading them in the middle of the day when it's like 85, 90 degrees outside. And we just just fell over and had a heart attack.
Oh, wow.
So we completely stopped that. Now we load about a half hour after dark, and we load for 2 hours, 3 hours, and then we just drive them straight to the processor. So it's like they're asleep. They never know what's going on, and it's cooler. It makes a world of difference.
Did you have to watch, did you ever watch Food Inc.?
Yep.
Did you? I watched it when I was a sophomore in high school. I don't know if in science class they showed it to you guys or not.
No, I didn't see it.
But that was the first time that I saw it. I think it was like 2010. Uh-huh. And it's interesting how relevant a lot of the themes in that documentary still are.
Right.
But one of the most compelling parts was a couple of the families that they had shown that were chicken farmers that were under contract with the big guys. So I was just wondering if you could maybe walk the audience through, like if you're a Tyson chicken farmer, Purdue, mm-hmm. what it's like to actually have to deal with some of those big guys and what their role is in the chicken industry.
Yeah. So I can only speak on what I know. I'm not an expert in this. I have been invited. I actually went to a meeting with someone who was trying to get us to put up barns and raise chickens for them. It wasn't Purdue or Tyson, but from my understanding, what these big companies try to do is they try to get a foothold on you as mm-hmm. much as they can. So they encourage you, they'll help get all the funding from a bank. You put up a big barn, but then you're under contract with them for however long, I'm not sure exactly. And then supposedly everybody 50% or better, anyone who has like a bigger chicken faster with less feed, they get a bonus. But it comes from the people that are raising it on the bottom half. Mm. So they're making everybody compete. I mean, there's probably a lot of animosity in those groups of like, I want to do better than you. I want mm-hmm. you to fail because you failing helps me. Dang. Which is just kind of it's not a very fun way to do business or have friends in the industry at all. But then what are you supposed to do if you have a couple $1 million in debt in these ginormous barns? Those barns can't be used for anything else. Yeah. You know, so they've got a foothold on you because you have to make that payment. And sometimes that's all you can do is just make that payment. Mm-hmm.
Can you speak to the role of just the processors and how the processors really do have kind of control on just, you know, you guys can do everything right on raising the animals, but these processors really control like the ins and outs of what's happening in the food system.
Yeah. So like JBS and Tyson, they own the processing. They don't own the farms themselves. But they own the processing because without that, you can't do anything, especially at that kind of scale, like hundreds of thousands or millions of birds. You can't do anything without the processing. So that's how another way they get a foothold on them. For us, we use small processors, obviously. So we're mm-hmm. not under any of that. You know, we have a good relationship with our processors. They can cater to, you know, different cuts we want and stuff like that. But these guys, they pretty much have no control. If you're raising for Tyson, mm-hmm. you don't get to decide anything. Oh. It's not even your chicken, really. All you own, this is the crazy thing. Tyson has convinced people that it's a good thing for the farmer to own 100% of the liability, which is the millions of dollars in debt that it takes to require to, you know, get a barn put up. But then they own the chicken, the feed, the processing, and then the distribution. It's like the valuable things the farm doesn't have any say in. It's only the things they don't want. Tyson doesn't want to have hundreds of millions of dollars in debt to all these barns.
Yeah. And then it's like, no wonder like food quality has now kind of been this like race to the bottom, which is a term that I think was recently used on one of our podcasts with Saif Al-Din. It's like food quality has just dropped off, you know, since like the 50s because we have this system that we're basically just putting a debt burden over all the people who are really putting the time and energy into raising these animals and trying to do it the right way.
Yeah. They have no incentive for that chicken to be healthier or better for you or a happier chicken. They get paid based on weight and mortality, and that's about it.
It's pretty amazing how you've been able to just stay independent since you were a young kid, essentially, and just carve your own path. I'm sure that's an amazing feeling.
Yeah, I have no desire at all to either be controlled by somebody else or to even farm that way. I mean, I don't hold judgment against the farmer because the farmer's not at fault.
Yeah.
It's the huge corporation that, and I'm not even against corporations in general, but when you just hold that over somebody like that, that's what I'm against.
100%. So you started when you were 14, 15. Mm-hmm. Did you go to college? Did you think about going to school?
Yeah. So I was homeschooled, all through high school, middle school, elementary. And then I went to a community college for 2 years, got a business associate's. None of my customers have ever asked to see my diploma. And I was like, I'm not doing anything more after this.
Well, that's why I was asking you, because it's so interesting because you had your trade ready to go at such a young age. So I'm sure from part of you was like, yeah, I could go to community college, learn a little bit, but like, I already know what I'm going to do. I just need to keep doing it better and better and iterate. Right.
So, and I should back up a little bit. I did have a business all through high school and college, but it wasn't financially viable until I got married in 2015, and we were living off my wife's salary for probably 2 years into our marriage until I could start taking a paycheck. So, I mean, I had already had the business for 6 or 7 years before I started taking any money out. I just reinvested all of it.
Have the past 3 years have been so interesting observing from afar just what's happening in the food system, the pressure that's been put on people who are creating food during the COVID crisis, and now inflation's just playing its role and making food more expensive for the consumer, and obviously input costs for you all is changing. So has that really like made you think more critically about your business and you know, what you're putting out there and like how you can actually continue to make it economically viable?
Yep. So we've been focusing a lot on direct consumer. We've been pretty much wholesale since day one, whether it be with institutions, restaurants, other farms. So we've been really trying to hone in on if we can get directly in front of the consumer, that profit margin is just a lot more.
Mm. What does that look like?
So that would be like either getting them right out to the farm to buy our meat or selling them like a half whole quarter cow, things like that, instead of going through like a grocery store where they're going to mark it up. Because that all just chips away at, you know, the farmer.
Yeah.
How important is social media in regards to getting in front of the customer right now? Is that a big thing for you guys that you're focused on?
I don't know if we're focused on it. We have tried to increase it quite a bit. From what I've understood talking to, there's some big guys out there like, well, big compared to us, like Seven Sons Farms. We work with them. And they've probably got, I don't know, 20,000 email subscribers or something like that. Yeah. And we've got like 800. And they always say email subscribers is, you know, you could post whatever you want on social media, but the email subscriber is what turns into revenue because you're getting that intimate right into their email. They've obviously shown interest. People could, I mean, I follow things all the time on Instagram or Facebook that I'm not that interested in. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't, you know, you could have 20,000 Instagram followers, but that doesn't mean any of them are really actually buying anything from you.
Yeah. Right.
What sort of hiccups have you run into with the direct-to-consumer model? Is there anything that you were like not expecting when you started transitioning the business more to the D2C route?
Yep. So I guess I probably should have expected it. You just have way more people to deal with. So if I sell 20,000 chickens to Primal Pastures, I've got one or two contacts at Primal Pastures that if I make them happy, I make them happy. Mm-hmm. Where if I'm selling to 100 or 200 customers, you're going to have a lot of people that are either overjoyed or sometimes, you know, you just got to make it right. So it just takes a lot more infrastructure and man hours to make sure everyone's getting taken care of. Everyone feels valued. So that's probably been the biggest challenge. And then also just distribution. So we started shipping through like FedEx, and that is a whole different ballgame.
I've heard that's a nightmare, right? Because if they misplace it, there's no insurance, you're eating the cost of it, right?
Yeah, exactly. And then that has to be built in. So that's why, you know, or free, you know, everyone wants free shipping. Yeah. And I'm the same way. Like if I have an order or something and I see $20 shipping, I'm like, what? $20 shipping?
Yeah.
But if I paid $20 more in my cart, I didn't even care.
Yeah. Yeah. We've gotten so spoiled with the Amazon model.
Amazon has kind of ruined that.
Yeah. So I think, did you say that in 2020, you guys were still doing eggs and now it's just broilers that you're doing?
Yeah, we got out in 2021 and we work with Seven Sons. Cool. So we still distribute eggs, but we're not raising them anymore.
What was the thought process behind that?
So we had an opportunity to grow a lot with the broilers, the turkeys and the beef. We just started doing beef actually in 2021. And that was the route I wanted to go. And we didn't have the man hours. The infrastructure was going to have to go up with the egg layers. That was taking just so much of our time. And when you really looked at the revenue it was bringing in, it was a lot less. Mm. So it was kind of like, we've got a great contact with Seven Sons. Let's fit right in with their model. Same, they do everything the same way we do it. Mm-hmm. And nice. I can go down there, and I've been down there plenty of times. All of our customers trusted us and everyone switched over. So it worked out really good.
What does that evolution of moving into the beef industry look like for you? And maybe what sparked that interest in starting to raise cattle?
Yep. So it was kind of out of like waste. Mm-hmm. So we were chickens don't want to go into grass that's 2 feet tall. They want to go where it's like just below their head or so. And we were just mowing it down with a tractor and a mower. And I'm like, what are we doing? Like, this is such a waste. So it was kind of like, we grow a lot of good grass. Why are we not turning that into more protein that we can sell? And it was kind of just I love chicken, but I love steak. I mean, you can't beat it. So I'm like, why are we not raising at least our own, but we might as well raise some more for other people. And it was surprisingly, it was a pretty easy transition. I mean, our customers latched on really well. Mm.
Do they like to buy beef in bulk too? Are you guys selling quarter, half, whole cows?
Yeah. So this past year, I think we cut up maybe 3 beef, which just to sell on our store, or our farm store and stuff like that. And then we sold another 15 or so as halves, quarters and wholes.
Nice.
And that's we might be getting over our heads this year, but we're bringing in 100 cattle this year.
Yeah.
And we're going to sell probably 50 of them to another farm, and then 50 of them has halves, wholes, and quarters.
Is there a model that you wish existed where like people could almost come in as partial owner? Because I think it does kind of exist, but it's like, if you knew how many cattle you needed to raise, you could basically have people come in as a membership and then you could just sell it to them and you just do all the work. It almost seems like the right model if people are interested in that.
Yeah, that's actually one of the reasons we've been able to grow sustainably is I haven't really like gone out on a limb and like, I'm going to buy a bunch of something that I don't know if I'm going to sell it or not. With wholesale, we get those contracts and we know we're going to sell it.
Right.
With the direct consumer, you're like going out on a limb, like, is it going to sell or is it not going to sell? So for the beef this year, we took like, I think it was $200 deposit for whole, 100 for half and 75 for quarter or something like that.
Nice.
We're going to up that though quite a bit. It's funny. I can't remember his name, but from Perennial Pastures, you guys had him on, and I got on their website and they're charging like $3,000 deposit. Yeah. And I'm like, why are we charging so little? Like, we have so much upfront costs to these cattle. Why are we not getting a larger deposit where they're committed and people, you know, if they have the funds upfront, they can really invest in the farmer.
Yeah.
I was going to say your deposit's dirt cheap. I would be all over that.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I think we're going to up that. And then that just gets people are still willing to walk away from $100, $200. Mm-hmm. If you've already put like 90% of what the final cost is going to be down, you're not walking away.
Yeah.
So that doesn't leave us stranded with anything.
Yeah. It's really cool to see the beef in bulk movement growing as well. Just people taking right their food sovereignty into their own hands and wanting to connect with you and shake your hand and ask you questions about the animal and stock their freezer. And it's just a completely different experience than it's just such a better level of connection than trying to buy something from the grocery store.
Yeah. There's always like good things that come out of bad situations.
Yes.
And COVID, one great thing, or even the avian influenza with eggs, let's say, but when they see empty shelves, people don't want to be the person that can't get meat or eggs. Mm-hmm. So they see all these memes of like the guy with chickens is like a king right now. They're like, we could have a freezer full of chicken if we wanted to.
Yeah.
We just had to buy it in bulk.
Yeah.
And you can say, you know, we kind of sell it as like, you get ribeye at the price of ground beef.
Yeah. Mm. A lot of people in the carnivore community shit on chicken. We were just talking about this the other day, which I think is a shame because I love chicken. I think especially because people will complain about the price of carnivore all the time, just being like, oh, you know, I don't have $15 to spend on a steak.
Right.
Like, dude, you get a good broiler chicken. You throw that thing in the oven, cook the whole bird for $6-7. It could feed the whole family. It's juicy. It's delicious. It's nutrient dense.
Yep.
It's I think that's one of the things that the carnivore community could do better is like accepting other types of protein besides just red meat.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
What are your guys' views? This is kind of off topic a little bit, but I've seen a lot of people also kind of going against like bugs. Like there's a lot of societies in this world that eat, you know, crickets or something like that. What are your guys' opinions on that?
Yeah, I think I was pretty biased before speaking with Bill Schindler,
okay.
who he published the book Eat Like a Human, and he started talking about it through that lens where it's like bugs have been this food that people in all different types of cultures have eaten for a long time.
Right.
You know, for me, it's still just like culturally.
Yeah.
Like I'm just not there. Yeah. Like,
you can't get it either. I mean,
you can't 100%. Get it.
Yeah.
And like we're spoiled in the US, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So, I have a tough time with that. And I do just think that like there are hierarchies to protein. And I think we had a guy, Stefan Van Vliet, on. And I think that, you know, he kind of breaks down like different types of proteins. And I think there is something to just like the more robust the animal being, the better the protein quality is. But I don't know if you have
we can
any.
Turn that bug into chicken.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And even outside of the nutrition, just the fact that there are groups of people, which I think this is the bigger issue, the fact that there are groups of people that are trying to suppress your right to animal protein and are trying to push like a bug substitute as opposed to you being able to eat beef or chicken or fish or something like that. I think that's what's interesting, but it's definitely a very nuanced thing. Cause it's like, there are cultures that obviously, I guess they thrive on eating bugs. It's less the nutrition and more so like, no, I want to be able to eat a steak if I want to eat a steak.
Yeah, exactly.
You know,
do you have a take on it?
Not really. I just thought it was interesting that it is in a lot of other cultures, but it's not in ours.
Yeah.
And you look at those cultures and they're generally speaking a lot healthier than ours.
Yeah. We got to get you going carnivore. That's what we need to do.
So I did it in August.
Oh, you did?
I did the, Heart and Soil did. It was like,
oh yeah, the AB
30.
Yeah.
The only thing I allowed myself, I'm like a huge, and it's going to sound crazy, I'm a huge sweet corn guy.
Mm.
And August is when sweet corn comes in and I get it from our local farm. And so I had like 5 ears of corn throughout that month. But otherwise I was like 100%. And I felt great. I mean, I ate liver every day. I still eat liver pretty consistently. And I'm also like meat is like the staple in my diet, but I'm not like 100% carnivore either. Mm.
So this nose to tail movement has gotten really popular in really the carnivore space, but people don't really talk about that through the lens of chicken. And I feel like there's all sorts of things that you can do with chicken. Like chicken feet is popular in other cultures, but not in the US.
Yep.
Are there parts of the bird that you think people should be thinking about eating more of?
So
chicken skin.
Yeah. Chicken. I mean, so it's funny. I keep bringing up Primal Pastures, but they're a great customers of ours and their customers want everything.
Right.
So we do keep all the feet, all the livers, hearts, The gizzard, we keep as many as we can. It's a little bit difficult because the processor, just labor issues of because you have to clean the gizzard really good. But they want all that. So they sell chicken skin, but just skin. Because they get boneless, skinless breasts.
Yeah.
The only thing that's relatively difficult to move would be like backs. And that's only because you can make so much broth off of one back. So it's like you get, and that's a huge portion of the chicken.
Yeah.
But no, I think that people do need to embrace other cuts and other parts of the chicken. Because as a chicken farmer, we can't really make a profit unless we're selling everything.
Yeah.
Like we could raise 100,000 chickens a year or more if we could just make money off selling the breasts, you know? Yeah. But people we need to sell the thighs, drumsticks, wings, necks, livers, hearts, everything.
Right. All of it. I had chicken feet for the first time at a Szechuan restaurant in San Francisco a couple months ago. It was freaking delicious, man. Yeah. It was awesome.
Believe it or not, I've actually like never eaten the foot itself, but I made a lot of broth with it.
You made a lot of broth with it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're great for that.
You probably make some incredible homemade bone broth.
Oh, my wife does.
Yeah.
It's good.
Just that thick collagen.
Mm-hmm.
So good.
Yeah. I was thinking about this when we were talking about beef. Does it... I feel like the grocery store has made people, it's just warped our perception around the nose to tail movement too. Like you go to the grocery store, there's just cuts of steak.
Yeah.
And now, from my understanding of ordering beef in bulk, it's like you don't get all that many ribeyes off of a cow.
Right. Yeah.
It's mostly ground beef.
Exactly.
Does that frustrate you as someone who's raising these animals with intention and really trying to like make sure that the animal's raised correctly? Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, there's only so much of the animal to go around. You have to eat the whole thing.
Yeah, right. Yes. Yes and no. I mean, I think there is, our direct-to-consumer customer is pretty good about, they yeah. want to use the whole thing.
Yeah.
And I really encourage them to, because they make a lot of the decisions at the processor themselves. I encourage them, because it doesn't cost them any more to get everything back. All the bones, you know, there's something you can do with everything. Even if you have a dog, give the bones to your dog. Like, just keep it all, because you're paying for it anyways. Yeah. And once people start, you know, trying to use everything, I mean, you can use ground beef in so many dishes. I think ground beef, for me personally, does get a little more difficult if you are trying to just be carnivore. Like,
totally.
Just eat ground beef is way more difficult than eating a ribeye or filet mignon or anything like that.
Yeah, that's something I'm trying to get better with too, because with the beef in bulk, it's mostly ground beef, but I'm like, fuck, the ribeye is so good. Yeah. The strip is so good.
Yeah.
But to Harry's point, it's like something that we've been trying to do since we've been out in Bastrop is like, let's just learn one new recipe every single week.
That's awesome.
And there's just so many different ways to prepare ground beef and different types of seasonings and throw some sauteed onions in or garlic or just like different things to kind of mix it up if you get that palate fatigue going carnivore.
Yeah. A way I like to use it when I did carnivore in August was just kind of like what Liver King does, is just a patty with cheese on it. You know, I'm not a huge like just ground beef in a bowl and just eat ground beef. But if it's got some cheese, it's delicious.
Yeah.
Have you
noticed any health benefits from doing the carnivore diet in August and then maybe even incorporating some liver and organ meats into the diet?
Yeah, the liver. So to be completely honest, this time of year, I don't know if it's like kind of a wear down from, you know, working pretty hard all summer and fall to now it's like a break, but I get sick around Christmas time almost every year. I got COVID really bad right a day after Christmas, not this past year, but the year before. And this year our household hasn't gotten any sickness at all. And I didn't eat much liver. I don't think I ate any liver before that. And I'm not saying that it's 100% it. There's a lot of things we changed. We changed a lot of products in our house too. But I think that's a huge one. But when I was done doing, like the end of August when I did carnivore, this kind of goes back to the conversation we were having earlier about like a sugar addiction.
Yeah.
I hadn't done it long enough to where I'd kicked my sugar addiction.
Yeah.
So I gave up pop like 11 years ago. And I gave it up for like three. I originally just gave it up for like 3 months. I don't know, like Lent or something. I don't know. And then I didn't miss it because it was long enough that I didn't even crave it anymore. So I just never went back to drinking pot.
Yeah.
So I should do it for like a 3 or 4 month period to where I'm like kicking those habits and that desire for sugar or for, you know, carbs in general.
Joe was saying that when we were on the elevator up to the studio, he was saying that prior to coming on the show, he listened to our most recent podcast with Pastor Scott.
Oh, cool.
And how he found like a lot of his honesty to be really relatable, because that was one of the things Scott was talking to us about, was just like sugar addiction and the dopamine that you get from eating those foods. And like, that's something that I struggle with too. Like, that's been like, I think the last thing for me that I still haven't kicked yet is like, every once in a while, just getting these desires to have like a diet soda or like just something sweet. And I still feel it too.
Yeah. And I like, what was his name? Scott?
Scott. Yeah.
I like what Scott said too, is like, he still had Thanksgiving dinner.
Yeah.
And then he just fasted the day after and he went back into it. Like, I don't know if I'll ever personally go 100% carnivore, but I'm finding kind of as I get older too, and we're at home a lot more, like, just adding small things into your diet and taking small things out can make a ginormous difference.
That can move the needle immeasurably. Just like eliminating the processed sugars, and eliminating is in like, you know, 99% of the time you're doing it the right way. Processed sugars, processed grains, processed oils, like that alone, most people will just see massive health benefits from.
Totally.
Yeah.
That's such a good mental model that you talked about nutrition. And we've been talking about this a lot more, like, I have so much respect for the carnivores that are 100% purists and they don't cheat, whether it's Christmas, their birthday, Thanksgiving. Like, that's beautiful. God bless them.
Yeah.
They probably understand their relationship to food, or maybe they have a really bad autoimmune disease.
Yep.
But I think the three of us are kind of in the camp of like, life is also meant to be enjoyed too. Mm-hmm. And the purpose of us eating meat and these really dense animal products is so you can build a resilient body. So like you can go on Thanksgiving and have some cranberry sauce and pie and mm-hmm. like understand like, look, it's one meal out of the year. I'm going to enjoy it. I'm going to spend time with my family. And then the next day I'm going to get up, I'm going to work out and I'm going to go back to my diet. Like there's, I think there's this kind of unhealthy relationship with food that certain people have. And, you know, life is about building a really resilient body and being able to have fun and go do badass things with your life too. And enjoy
it. And that's
it.
How it used to be.
Yes. Yeah.
Like you didn't have a Coke 4 times a day.
No.
You had a Coke, like it was a special thing to go get a Coke.
Yeah.
Like it was maybe a once a month or what, I don't know. But it wasn't, there wasn't this constant supply of sugary drinks and sugary mm-hmm. food always in front of you. But now it's just everywhere.
Yeah. You're just over inundated with that resistant, like you almost have to, people who struggle with it, they have to be present so they can mm-hmm. say no. But it's like, you know, when it's not all that hard to find, or it just makes it so challenging for people who are struggling.
Yeah.
If they're white knuckling their diet, which is such a terrible relationship 100%. With food and everything that you're trying to do to fuel your body and feel good.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard because I feel like so many people struggle with their diet now, and it really should be viewed as fuel. And mm-hmm. it shouldn't be this thing that you're struggling with all the time.
Totally. Yeah. A lot of women in particular, they think that to diet, they need to be in this insane caloric restriction.
Oh. Right.
And we've had on a lot of women that have gone animal-based or gone carnivore and eating all this really nutrient-dense saturated fat. It's like they've helped mm-hmm. their hormones, their PMS symptoms, their fertility.
Yep.
And women are on like the brunt end of a lot of this because they think they can't eat, or if they like eat too much protein or fat, they're going to get fat, which is the complete opposite of the case.
Yeah. It's funny that you just brought up fertility because I've got an almost 5-year-old son, and me and my wife had felt a calling to adopt for a long time.
Mm.
And we started the adoption process in January of 2020, about the worst time you could start an adoption process. So that drug on for almost 2 years before we were like, okay, let's take a pause on trying to adopt and we'll come back. We thought we got pregnant right away when we tried with our first. We'll just have a baby. We'll get pregnant. It didn't go that way.
Yeah.
And she is pregnant now. She's 2 months till she's due. Mm. And we're super thankful for that.
It's
incredible. Thank you. But it was a long road of diet. And then, like I said, we changed a lot of, there's just perfumes and chemicals in everything.
It's insane.
And so we switched out all of our body wash, everything, detergent, hand soap, deodorant, toothpaste, everything switched out.
Wow.
And we got pregnant. And I don't think that's a coincidence.
You actually mentioned that in April when we met you for the first time. Yeah. What kind of soaps and stuff do you guys like to use? I feel like.
So my body wash is White Oaks Pastures, mm-hmm. which is
nice.
Primarily, I believe, just.
I think it's tallow.
Tallow based.
We use Primally Pure mm-hmm. for deodorant and Branch Basics for like hand soaps and detergents. And our toothpaste, I cannot remember the brand of our toothpaste.
It's pretty interesting. It kind of goes, this whole conversation reminds me of what you're talking about with like showing up to the grocery store and seeing the blank shelf. Like the uh-huh. same thing applies when you're going through something where you're trying to like have a child and you can't. It's like, oh my gosh, like what's affecting this? And so many people are dealing with this. Like so many people are struggling to conceive, and mm-hmm. a lot of it isn't just diet. Like there are so many lifestyle components that people don't even realize are affecting their hormones, whether it's, you know, the water they're drinking mm-hmm. or the things that they're putting on their skin.
Yep.
It just surprises me. And I think to the average person, it might not even seem all that obvious, but then you go through the struggle and you're like, oh my gosh, these things are actually affecting how I feel.
Yeah. And I'm super thankful. We made a decision early on in our marriage. My wife Adele was on birth control for probably 2 months when we first got married. And we just noticed like her hormones were just out of whack.
Really?
And we got off of that and haven't gone back. And I think that's a huge, huge problem today is it's getting in our water supply.
100%.
It's crazy. I mean, not ours, we're on a well, thank goodness. But like majority of society has so much higher estrogen levels in their water and all sorts of things. And it can be traced back to, a lot of it can be traced back to birth control.
Yeah. It's amazing how many people are starting to wake up and this movement is really starting to grow steam. But it's also going to be interesting because we're all around the same age. So mm-hmm. we're at that point where a lot of our friends and family are starting to get married, have kids. It's just going to be fascinating to see how this whole thing plays out over the next decade or so, where it's like testosterone rates, sperm count, lowest in recorded history, epidemic of birth control, all these endocrine disruptors that are now out there. It's just going to be really interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, for sure.
One of the things I wanted to ask you, so we started on Twitter, and on Twitter there's this massive movement on slonking eggs, and I'm wondering if you've heard of it. And
I assume not to change subject.
Yeah, drinking them raw.
Yeah.
Have you heard of it? And what are your thoughts on it?
I've seen people like do challenges where they drink a bunch of raw eggs. I mean, it's been the bodybuilding community has been drinking raw eggs for a long time.
Yes.
I think there's a lot of benefits to it. I would definitely be super confident in the farm you're getting them from.
Yeah.
I've never been scared of like raw cookie dough or anything with raw egg in it. But if you're just going to up the ante and just be drinking raw eggs, get them from a good source.
Mm.
For sure. But I think it's totally good. I mean, the egg is the purest form of protein we have.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think the whole movement for like egg whites,
it's insane.
It's terrible. I don't know what, I don't know where that came from.
So bad.
All the good shit's in the yolk.
Exactly. Yeah. If you had to choose one, I would drink just the yolk if you can, but they balance each other. Like you need the fats to break down the proteins. God didn't make a mistake when he made the egg.
Yeah.
He knew that you needed both of them.
Right.
So when you start separating things like that, it just gets kind of crazy in my mind.
Yeah. It's like when you go to a diner and it's like they label it like the healthy omelet or the bodybuilder omelet.
Yeah.
And it's like egg white, broccoli. And I'm like, I wouldn't eat any of this
shit
anymore.
Exactly.
Like,
it tastes terrible.
Yeah, exactly.
Give me all the yolk. Give me all the cheese. Give me all the bacon, all the fat.
Exactly. Right?
Yeah, there are so many things in the food system that like I feel like happened while we were like growing, our generation was growing up. It was like skim milk.
Yeah.
Like
that's what you were drinking.
Yeah, I was
still grew to be a monster.
We had both. We had whole and skim. Yeah. My dad drank whole, my mom drank skim, and it's like the skim tastes like water. Like
it's actual water.
It was like sugary water, and that was it.
Yeah, it's like when I go home to my parents' house, there's such an aversion. There's such a fear of saturated fat. And I'm like, okay. You won't buy whole milk, but then when I go in the pantry, it's like you've got vegetable oil and chips and all this shit.
Right.
And it's Crisco. Like they want it in Crisco and they want to do the right thing. It's just they've been misled, unfortunately. It's it's a shame.
Yeah.
Have you seen the Tufts University Food Compass study that came out?
Is it just came out?
I think it came out like 6 months ago, but it's been totally repopularized because mainstream has picked it up.
Is that where it talks about like Lucky Charms or something being better than ground
beef? The food ranking score. Yes. Yeah.
I'm like, this is where it all starts, right?
Yeah.
Like how, in what world is Frosted Mini Wheats in the 90th percentile? For
encouraged.
Yeah.
Like, and it's almost, I hope it's so extreme that people are like, even if you're not into like this huge health, like quest that you're going on, but you can see this isn't right. This can't be right.
Yeah.
I'm almost sitting here going, I almost think this is intentional where they're just trying to like breed this distrust in the information. Cause like, I can't sit there and be like, who in the right mind has a degree, like a PhD and is saying that Frosted Mini Wheats are better than beef and eggs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't get like, just it's humorous. It's like,
no, it's
go eat till you're full of ground beef and eggs. And go eat until you're full of mini wheats and tell me which one feels better.
Mm-hmm.
You like, at least personally, like my body digests beef. Like I could go run
so
a mile
well.
Or, I mean, I'm not a great runner, so a mile is really long.
But after eating a pound of ground beef,
if I eat a pound of sugary carbs, like I'm passed out. Like
passed
I can't
out.
Do anything.
Or shitting yourself.
Yeah.
This is what I would be doing.
Right.
Yeah. It's almost like the other side, they've overplayed their hands so much that the average person that following a standard American diet is like, okay, I don't really know how to eat, but I know that this shit definitely isn't right. That Lucky Charms is not healthier than eggs.
Yeah. It's right? crazy.
Yeah. It was a shame that we didn't have the camera rolling when we first met. I wanted to say that at the beginning of the podcast, because I feel like there were so many great points that we just like got into just about like the world and like what's happening. And it was just so great to like get you back on the show and be able to have this conversation, because I feel like we at least did it right and had a similar type of conversation.
Yeah, we always say that the best part for us this entire year has just been the relationships that we formed in the space.
Mm-hmm.
So to see someone that's as young as you are just pushing forward and just absolutely building out this incredible operation and like really passionate about providing your customers with the best form of protein that you can get. Mm-hmm. It's really cool for us and it's inspiring for us and makes us just want to continue to grow the show and just have on other amazing people. So just appreciate what you do, man. And just thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Nice show.
Thanks.
Round two, stashes.
Dude, I shaved the stash today. What a mistake.
Oh, we didn't know.
Dude, what a mistake. I don't even know what compelled me to do it. I was just like, fuck it.
All right, round two.
In a few weeks, we'll do a stash.
Thanks, Joe.
Come back.
Yeah. Awesome. Thanks, man.
Yeah, thanks.